Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy it. This story is part one of a two-part presentation going into the life and times of the most influential University of Oregon graduate of all time, Yosuke Frank Matsoka, whose star of destiny in life would lead directly to the destruction of Nazi Germany and eventually the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I've been hinting around about this all week long, and it's finally time now to put the pieces together, which I will do in the next two and final two episodes in this sequence. They're the last two in a total run of six podcast episodes drawing from three different Offbeat Oregon columns. In the last episode, we finished the story of William Dunbar and his industrial-scale smuggling operation, bringing opium by the shipload into the old Portland waterfront, while the bought and paid for head of the local customs office, Jim Lotan, looked the other way. Meanwhile, as I mentioned briefly, Dunbar had informally adopted a spunky, gregarious Japanese boy who called himself Frank. And today we're going to talk about Frank. And we're going to talk about how this little waterfront punk became the pivot point around which the fate of the world turned. I'm not even kidding about that. I personally am thoroughly convinced that you and I probably owe our lives and the fact that our beautiful world is not a sooty radioactive cinder to Frank Matsoka. Not that he knew what he was doing, of course, but that no Frank Matsoka, nuclear holocaust, probably in 1961. Anyway, let's get started. It may be that the movement of a butterfly's wings on one side of the world can seed a tornado on the other. Whether it's literally true or not, it is certainly figuratively true, and nowhere is it better demonstrated than in the case of 1890s businessman and opium smuggler William Dunbar of Portland, Oregon, the guy we just got done talking about. If we could take Dunbar out of the stream of history before about 1890, we would derail events that led directly to Imperial Japan's alliance with Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy in 1940, to Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor the following year, and to the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, and maybe to the fact that the world did not end in a multi-gigaton nuclear fireball in late October of 62. All this because a politically well-connected drug smuggler in a tiny faraway Portland was unusually incompetent and had taken a young Japanese boy into his household as a companion for his 14-year-old son. That little boy's name was Frank Matsoka. His real name was Yosuke. And he would go on to become the foreign minister of Imperial Japan and the chief architect of the Tripartite Pact with Germany and Italy just before the Second World War. Yosuke Matsoka was born in 1880 in the village of Morozumi in Yamaguchi Prefecture. He was the son of a local shipping company owner, but when he was very young, his father's business collapsed into bankruptcy after one of his ships sank, and his father died within a few years, a broken man. Matsoka spent most of his preteen years with his widowed mother in proud poverty. In 1891, Matsoka's mother agreed to let him venture overseas to do what he could to restore the family's fortunes. So on February 23, 1893, following some crash course English instruction, Matsoka boarded the steamship Tacoma in Kobe, bound for Victoria, British Columbia. And about a month after he arrived, Matsoka joined the Dunbar household. William Dunbar, as we've noted, was a wealthy widower and owner of Dunbar Produce and Grocery and Turner Flouring Mills and co-owner of the Merchant Steamship Company. And, as we've also noted, a drug smuggler. Under the cover of his political connections with the Port of Portland's chief customs inspector, James Lotan, he ran an industrial-scale operation smuggling opium and illegal immigrants from China to British Columbia and thence into Portland. He owned two full-size steamships, the Wilmington and the Haitian Republic, operating out of the Dunbar Produce and Grocery Wharf, just north of the Burnside Bridge, in Portland's Old North End. The steamships brought in groceries and produce from Vancouver for sale through Dunbar's wholesale grocery business, of course, and they also carried shipments of Turner Mills wheat and flour to customers in China. But when the ships returned from those China trips, having unloaded their cargo, it must have seemed a real shame to just have them steam back home empty. So on the return trips, Dunbar's steamers took on passengers. Lots of passengers, most of them Chinese workers, each of whom paid $125 to be smuggled into the U.S. And, of course, the ships brought back opium. Opium by the ton. At one point, they were supplying the entire West Coast with the stuff. As we've discussed, the Wilmington and Haitian Republic kept up this trade for a year or two, starting in 1890 or so, and by 1893, when Matsoka came on the scene, their operations were kind of an open secret on the waterfront. Pretty much everybody knew what they were doing. They had started unloading the passengers at sea into small boats before arriving in port so they wouldn't be caught with them. This may actually be how Matsoka got to Portland, although later in his life he always was happy to talk about his voyage across from Kobe on the Tacoma, which was stormy and miserable. He never spoke much about the journey from British Columbia to Portland. Most biographers have tended to assume that it was a simple, uneventful railroad journey, and so it may have been. But if he was actually smuggled illegally into the country by Dunbar's crew, he certainly wouldn't have wanted to talk about that in later years after he'd grown up and become a diplomat. As for the opium, the Wilmington and Haitian Republic crews made those deliveries by simply rolling the barrels off the back of the ship in a remote part of the river before putting into port for gang members in small launches and scows to pick up out of the drink. Thus, by the time each ship dropped anchor in Portland Harbor, it would be clean and honest and ready for customs inspection. This, then, was the family business that Matsoka joined as a 12-year-old boy. A gregarious and outgoing lad, he must have gotten to know many of old man Dunbar's sketchy business associates, including probably notorious Shanghaier Joseph Bunko Kelly and flamboyant merchant steamship co-owner Nat Blum. He probably also learned a great deal about the opium trade. The household consisted of Dunbar, his 13-year-old son Lambert, and his widowed sister Isabel Beveridge. Matsoka joined the family in a similar way, like I said a couple of times already, to the character of Haji in the old Johnny Quest cartoons, a sort of foster brother and companion for Lambert. Mrs. Beveridge took a particular interest in the young Japanese boy and spent countless hours with him working on his English pronunciation and helping him and Lambert with their schoolwork. In later years, people would remark on Yosuke Matsoka's Scottish accent, which seemed somewhat unlikely coming from a Japanese man. Anyway, it was an idyllic life for Matsoka, but it couldn't last. Dunbar's smuggling operations were too flagrant. The underworld characters he had working for him were too unreliable. In December of 1893, the boom came down. 15 people were arrested on smuggling and human trafficking charges, including Dunbar and Jim Lotan. Lotan, of course, in addition to being Portland's customs inspector, was a very prominent member of Portland's business elite and the president of the Oregon Republican Party, so his presence in the trial guaranteed a lot of media coverage. It ended with a hung jury, and the process of getting a trial rescheduled dragged out well into 1894. Dunbar's business partner, Nat Blum, turned state's evidence and testified against him, but did so creatively. By the end of the second trial attempt, no one believed a word he said anymore. And that's when Dunbar left on a quote-unquote business trip to Hong Kong and stayed there in exile, leaving young Lambert and Matsoka with Mrs. Beveridge. In 1898, Matsoka enrolled in the University of Oregon, pursuing an undergraduate degree in law. After graduation, he spent some time trying to get admitted to an Ivy League grad school back east, a law school, and if he'd been left to his own devices, he probably would have succeeded. But back in Japan, his mother's health was declining fast, so in 1902, he decided it was time to return to his native land. Well, Yosuke Matsoka left his Oregon home for the last time in 1902, when he was 22 years old, and he had lived in Oregon, briefly California, since age 12. His Oregon years had been happy ones. He would remember them fondly for the rest of his life. Oregon would remember him fondly, too. Within 25 years of his graduation, he would be probably the most famous University of Oregon alumnus in the world. That, of course, was all in the future. Just now, back in Japan, Matsoka was not finding his hard-earned U of O degree very useful. No Japanese universities would recognize it for grad school purposes, and that effectively foreclosed future studies at Tokyo Imperial University. And as the son of a merchant, he lacked any of the family connections that might be parlayed into a civil service career, nor did he have any law school connections that could help him in Japan. so he took the Foreign Service exam instead and launched a career as a diplomat. As a diplomat, Matsuoka was excellent. His natural gift of gab had been nurtured and shaped in the boisterous outgoing style of frontier Oregon. He'd worked in a newspaper office in Oakland, California for long enough to get along well with reporters. He could be garrulous and gaffe-prone, but he was generous with his time, was obviously brilliant, and was very good at the political games that always come along with diplomatic organizations. He quickly rose through the ranks. After the First World War, he was in the Japanese delegation to the Versailles Peace Conference. For many years after that, he served as an executive in the South Manchurian Railway Company, a Japanese-owned railroad cutting through Chinese territory, which Japan had seized from Tsarist Russia in the Russo-Japanese War. Then, in 1931, came the Manchuria Incident. A cabal of Japanese army officers blew up some dynamite near a South Manchurian railway line and blamed the Chinese for it, and used it as a pretext to invade and occupy Manchuria and set up the puppet state of Manchukuo there. These are junior officers doing this. Faced with this fait accompli, and wanting, of course, to keep the stolen territory, the Japanese government backed the officers up, instead of court-martialing them. The League of Nations strongly objected, and Matsuoka, by now a widely internationally known diplomat, was assigned to the League of Nations to handle the fallout. Matsuoka was bitterly opposed to the idea of withdrawing from the League of Nations, and he tried very hard to prevent that from happening. But ironically enough, it was he that had to lead the Japanese delegation in their dramatic walkout on February 24, 1933. On the way back to Japan, Matsuoka worried what his reception might be. After all, diplomacy had failed. Japan had withdrawn from the League of Nations. As a businessman, he knew what a bad thing that was. Internationally, it was a bad look. It made Japan look like a rogue state. Japan, of course, was at that time a rogue state, but the diplomatic corps was kind of keen for it not to look that way. However, when he arrived home, he was welcomed as a hero. The pageantry of the Japanese delegation's dramatic exit, with their heads held high in solemn dignity, had appealed to the populace. Matsuoka, at that moment, was the most popular man in Japan, other than the actual emperor. But all was not as peachy as it might have looked from far away. With no personal family networks to support him, he had to seek support where he could find it. The business elites that would ordinarily be with him were furious about Japan's withdrawing from the League of Nations. It may have been an important point of national honor, but it was going to cost them a lot of money. Japan was now almost an international pariah state. And yet the population of farm laborers and farm workers loved him. So Matsuoka took the path of William Jennings Bryan, whom he had met once, actually, in California, and he stepped into the role of a populist politician. His idea was to build a fascist-style grassroots organization similar to the one that Mussolini had developed in Italy. But after 2 years of barnstorming around the country giving populist speeches, he realized he wasn't going to be able to get enough traction to build the mass support that he would need to overcome the challenges of being a political outsider. So in 1935, when offered the presidency of the South Manchuria Railroad, he accepted and went back to Manchuria. Then in 1940, Fumimaro Konoe took over as prime minister. Seeking a foreign minister who knew diplomacy and would get along well with the army and navy ministers, who were the real power in Imperial Japan at that point, Konoe tapped Matsuoka for the job. So, how would our boy Frank do as foreign minister of Imperial Japan? Depends on your perspective. From the standpoint of the average Japanese citizen, the moves Matsuoka made set them up for a season of indescribable hell. From a standpoint of anyone alive in or after October 29th, 1962, well, all of us probably owe our lives to this guy. I'll explain that more, what I've been hinting at for considerable time now, but I'll unpack it in full detail in tomorrow's episode. The last episode in this sequence. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Say, are you an audiobook listener? And do you enjoy old pre-war pulp stories like Tarzan of the Apes and Conan the Barbarian and The Call of Cthulhu and stuff like that? Or do you like early Victorian penny dreadful fiction like Sweeney Todd and Varney the Vampire and Highwayman Dick Turpin? If so, you might enjoy the audiobooks I have out there in the world. The easiest way to find them is for the search for my name on audible.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Organ History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.